يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis, where we look at all the various huge number of issues in the Middle East North Africa region with our regular studio guest, Dr. Harry Hagopian. Now, I probably don't need to remind you, but I'm going to anyway. Dr. Harry Hagopian is the Bishop's Consultant on the Middle East North Africa region. He's also an international lawyer, an analyst, and former Assistant General Secretary of the Middle East Council of Churches, whose offices are in Lebanon. Now, that is actually very important because the first topic of conversation is going to be the clashes between the Alawites and the Sunni Muslims in North Lebanon. Mm-hmm. We're also going to get across Syria. We mentioned the six-point plan of Kofi Annan in our previous podcast. We're going to just look at how that's going. And also, with a new French president, ask the question as to whether France's policy towards Syria has changed in any way. I'll be keen for Harry's views on that. And then we will cross to Palestine. Now, my question there is going to be new day, new government, because there is one, and I want to know what this one is going to do that is in any way different from the previous ones. So, Harry, you're very welcome. Great to see you as always.
Thank you, James.
I've basically gone outside of this room, which I appreciate you can't see, gone into the corridor, grabbed Harry by his scarf, which he always wears, even if it's 1,000 degrees, and dragged him into the studio for this podcast. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Today was an unexpected interview, James, but always a pleasure to be in this familiar studio.
Well, I'll join in that loving and agree with you. So, Harry, North Lebanon and the serious matter of clashes between the Alawite community and the Sunni community, basically over Syria.
Basically over Syria, James. And it's very interesting because one of the things I do every morning to prop myself up with the latest developments overnight in the Middle East and North Africa is go through a few stations, television and radio stations, both Arab and international, and the BBC, in order to see what has happened and what are the latest developments in this part of the world. And one of those stations where I stop is Al Jazeera, which have a review of the press. And it's fascinating because it's a half-hour program, and at the end there is a three-minute caricature page where they have different sketches and caricatures of the whole region, which I find extremely helpful and quite amusing at times. And today I was watching this particular program, and the last one was one which showed Lebanon and Syria. And in Syria it showed a huge conflagration. Next door to it, neighboring Lebanon, it showed the cedar tree, which is the symbol of Lebanon, and how some of the flames from that huge fire, that conflagration in Syria, actually coming over to Lebanon and beginning to burn some of the branches of the cedar tree, which represents Lebanon. And in a sense, what I'm trying to say is that one of the fears that the Lebanese people have had, and the world community has had also, is that usually when things go wrong in Syria, Lebanon suffers the consequences as well. And everybody has been saying, we hope that this time, with the increase in killings, with the increase in the violence in Syria itself, that it is not going to be either by omission or commission imported into Lebanon, because Lebanon is such a cauldron of different confessional loyalties. There are probably half the country is with the Syrian regime and the other half is against the Syrian regime and supportive of the uprisings. And interestingly enough, this doesn't divide in Christian-Muslim terms, because there are Muslims, largely the Sunnis, whom I suspect would be supporting the uprisings in neighboring Syria. The Shia would be divided, but largely with the regime, because Hezbollah is to a large extent with the regime for reasons that they probably know better than I do. And the Christians are divided probably half-half between those supporting the regime and supporting the uprising. So in a sense, this is a worry, because Lebanon is a cauldron, it's a tinderbox. And if it sort of goes aflame, then it's dangerous. And in Tripoli, there are two districts. One is called Jabal Muhsin and one is called Bab al-Tabana. One is largely peopled by Alawite community and the other one by Sunni. And it's almost a barometer of what happens for the rest of the country. Tripoli is also poor socioeconomically. It has other problems as well. But in a sense, it reflects the realities of what's happening in Syria. And there have been clashes over the past few days. The army army stepped in, the clashes were quelled, but they've sort of started up again. And this is one of the worries I have, that what is happening in that large neighbor Syria should not be exported into Lebanon.
Now, you've told us what the Sunni Muslims broadly are probably supportive of the uprising.
Yep.
What's the score with the Alawites?
The Alawites would be supporting, of course, the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And in that sense, the tensions are between those communities. And it could be anyway, like in this case, it was the arrest of a 27-year-old young man, Maulawi, who was arrested by the special branch of the security services. And he's a Sunni, so the Sunnis thought that this is provocative. There were clashes between the two communities. And the problem with Lebanon, and I love Lebanon dearly, the problem with that country is that it just takes one spark to ignite a fire, and then the fire spreads quite quickly. So what the Lebanese have done, because they have had over 15 years of civil war, where they have tasted the bitterness of what it means to bomb each other, kill each other, that they have been doing their best, that despite their differences, despite their political and ideological differences, they have tried to isolate themselves from what's happening in Syria, and to literally sit on the fence and not take sides. And to a large extent, that has worked politically. But it takes those sparks, and if those sparks are left unchecked, then they could be a harbinger for more trouble in the future.
Now, before we move on from Lebanon, I just want to ask you about Pope Benedict XVI and the fact that obviously he will be visiting Lebanon in September this year to sign the Apostolic Exhortation, the mm-hmm. document that comes off the back of a bishop's meeting in Rome that focused on the Middle East.
Absolutely.
Is that trip in danger?
The trip is not in danger, and I think it is going to happen. And interestingly enough, it is a very important visit that the Pope is undertaking at the end of September to Lebanon. I think that Apostolic Exhortation, as you explained, will be the sum total of all the deliberations that the bishops and patriarchs and archbishops of all the Catholic churches across the Middle East and North Africa had in Rome at their synod. And in a sense, it will flesh out a little bit some of what is needed in order to renew the mission of the church, to renew the ministry of the church, and make the church become more relevant to the communities that it serves in those countries. And by relevant and renewal, I don't mean necessarily boss the communities around, but be part and parcel of the fabric and makeup of those communities. So I think that meeting will take place. And interestingly enough, our own Archbishop of Liverpool, Archbishop Patrick Kelly, is going to be in Lebanon before the Pope. In fact, at the end of June, where there is going to be a Muslim-Christian summit taking place in Lebanon, again to talk about interreligious dialogue. And the main chair of that summit will be the Mufti of Tripoli, that town where we just talked about experiencing and witnessing those clashes.
Now, I'm going to say this probably for my own benefit as much as one or two of our listeners as well, but we have two Tripolis, of course, don't we?
Of course we do. And we yes, you're smiling, because when we talk of Tripoli, we mean Tripoli as in the capital of Libya. Mm. We hardly ever talk about Tripoli as in the north of Lebanon. But this one we're talking about today, surprisingly enough, is not the Tripoli of Libya, but that of Lebanon.
Thank you for clearing that up. Harry, I'd like to move on to Syria, because that obviously is what's underpinning our discussion in a certain
True.
Sense. Kofi Annan's six-point plan, I mentioned that in the intro. I also mentioned whether, you know, French foreign policy might take a different turn with the new president. So give us a little wrap on that, please.
Well, the six-point plan is still a six-point plan. It hasn't been reduced to five, nor has it been expanded to seven. But the uncertainties that beset this six-point plan, which we discussed in some detail in our previous podcast, James, are still the same. The monitors are there, but interestingly enough, the monitors actually had their convoy attacked by shelling only yesterday, and that put the lives of the monitors themselves in danger. That, to me, shows not only how violent the situation has become, how volatile the situation has become, but also how unpredictable it has become, that it is no longer even Syrians attacking Syrians, or Arabs attacking Arabs, or even mercenaries, if there are such things in Syria. I don't know. I'm not a prophet. But that even those monitors, those few monitors that are beginning to see what is happening in the country, they're also being subject to attacks. So there is more danger and there is more imminence of danger and threat in the country.
Now, the aim, I believe, was to scale it up as much as possible to as many as, I think, 300 was the amount that was approved.
Indeed.
As a maximum. How many are there at the moment?
There are about 100 of them, less than 100 of them. They're building up. The problem is to train them, to send them there, the logistical preparations that are required for them, and also their ability to move around and what their mission is. Those people aren't there to referee or to divide communities. Their mission is to report, but there is so much danger of their being manipulated by both sides. The regime wanting to manipulate those monitors by saying that, look, we are doing everything we can, etc., etc., the usual spiel that comes out of a totalitarian regime. And then you've also got the protesters and the demonstrators who are at their wits' ends at the moment because they do not perceive that the world community, let alone the Arab world, is helping them as much as they would wish them to be supportive. And in that sense, they're also taking those monitors and saying, come and see what's happening in Homs, what's happening in Idlib, what's happening in Dara, what's happening in different places. So in a sense, there is still that tension, there is still that uncertainty as to what happened. And I reiterate what I said last time, the six-point plan is the last chance saloon in terms of hoping for a peaceful wrap-up of what happens, or at least preventing it from becoming wider and more dangerous. But in terms of the French impact, all I would say is that the election of François Hollande as the socialist president in France, I do not think will impact much French policy on Syria. I think pretty much it will follow what President Nicolas Sarkozy did, which would be supportive of democratization, supportive of freedoms of expression. So in a sense, yesterday, President Bashar al-Assad gave an interview to Russia 24 program in which he basically advised or admonished the new French president to change his views and not to be supportive of the uprisings. I think that in itself was also a bit of stage-managed PR job. I think that François Hollande, from the initial statements he's made, will pretty much follow in the footsteps of his predecessor.
Harry, let's conclude with Palestine. Now, I'm losing track, you know, a new government for Palestine, new day, new government. Is this going to make a difference? What, is there going to be a new line on it, new angle? Are we going to see any movement?
Well, it's interesting, James, because you say you're losing track. Yes, there have been changes in the Palestinian Authority makeup, but less so and less frequently than the changes in government across the River Jordan in Jordan itself. So in that sense, not so dramatic as in Jordan. However, this was a long overdue and long expected reshuffle, and it basically was quite interesting because what is happening in Palestine are two things which almost are antipodean in political terms. On the one hand, Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the National Authority, is trying to see if there is any scope or any space for relaunching some sort of negotiations with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And on the other hand, he's also trying to make his peace and lead towards some reconciliation with Hamas, which control Gaza and which are an important dimension of the whole Palestinian issue. So he's basically caught between those two realities, and they're not always realities that go well together. Now, what he has done a reshuffle, which he said would serve the purpose of leading toward the reconciliation. And the moment there is a national unity government that includes all the Palestinian factions, including Hamas, this government would no longer be. However, the interesting thing about this government is that one of the issues that some people have had is whether Dr. Salam Fayyad should remain prime minister. Now, Mahmoud Abbas has confirmed him as prime minister, but interestingly enough, he actually has split his twin portfolios, kept him as prime minister, in other words, takes care of the whole government, but he's taken away the finance portfolio from him and given the finance portfolio to a very able, in my opinion, bureaucrat. He's a nuclear physician, Palestinian, who used to be formerly the principal of Bir Zeit University, Dr. Nabil Kassis. And I've had the pleasure of working with Dr. Nabil Kassis when I was consultant to Bethlehem Project 2000. And Bethlehem 2000 happened, James, during the Oslo period, where the idea was how to revamp, to redo, to modernize the infrastructure and tourism and everything to do with the Bethlehem Triangle, leading up to what we thought then would be permanent peace between Israel and the Palestinians. How naive were we 10, 15 years ago, weren't we? But I was impressed by Dr. Nabil Kassis's integrity and discipline then, and I'm very hopeful that he will also be such. Also, interestingly enough, another name that some of our listeners might know who's in the new cabinet, and that's Dr. Hanan Ashrawi. In fact, the only woman minister in the government. So at least there is a woman. Let's try and spin it positively. And of course, she brings a lot of experience, but there are also other fresh women who hopefully will eventually join the cabinet at some stage.
Well, we'll keep our eye on that, Harry, as indeed we will with the presidential elections in Egypt. We've got quite a lot coming up, and I know you're visiting the region yourself, so I'm going to nab you for another Middle East analysis in the coming couple of weeks before that. Thank you very much for this whistle-stop tour. Good focus on North Lebanon there, but also thank you for touching on Palestine and Syria, of course, as well.
And always, let's keep everybody in the Middle East, Christians and non-Christians alike, in our prayers.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Dr. Harry Hagopian, Bishop's Consultant on the Middle East North Africa region. Thank you very much.
Pleasure, James.